everyone. Welcome back to The Growth Signal, where we are rethinking how we build our customer relationships, how we keep them, and how we continue to lead as customer expectations rapidly evolve. My name is Alyssa Nolte.
And I am Dennis DM Metter.
And we are going to have a wonderful conversation today. And I'm so excited to get right into it. What is your hot take?
My hot take is everyone's complaining about AI writing right now, right? I just wrote a piece called "You Say You Hate M Dashes. I Don't Think You Know What That Means." And so what people don't realize, and because I started like reading and studying and I was like, okay, so what's going on? Like, why is AI writing like this with the little, you know, dot, 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 or dash, dash, dash? Like, what is this whole thing? And so started reading it, articles, studying it, and I learned that essentially that the language learning models need to parse data in the way that we're reading it in order to be able to use it and to access it correctly. So what's happening right now is there's a lot of writers who, I'm not going to use AI, or I'm not going to write in that style. And everyone's like, if I see M dashes on your posts on LinkedIn, I'm unfollowing you. There's just like a lot of hate going on.
Yeah.
And I kind of liken it to if we're sitting in 2003 to 2005 and then people saying, I don't want meta tags and keywords on my website. That's ugly. Why do I have to say that I'm in Atlanta, Georgia three times on the first page? This is dumb. This is ugly. In other words, we are fighting against the tide of what's coming to us. And the people who are spending all this time writing all this content that looks so free and clear of AI structuring are going to have that exact piece of content disappear into the ethosphere, and the citations and the structure of these new generative engine optimizations, GEO is what they're calling it now, the ones who embrace, doesn't mean that you have to let it write for you, but if you learn to write in its style without fear of repercussions from your fellow writers, you will put your business in a much better place in 3 years from now. So that's my hot take. Stop complaining about the new formats. Embrace it, because this is what the machine reads.
So two things. One, I've been using an M-dash since 2015, and I'm so bitter that I'm not...
Before it was cool.
Before it was cool, and I'm not allowed to use one anymore. It drives me crazy. Like, I feel so dumb because I'm writing and I use an M-dash, and I'm like, nope, got to get rid of it, because then people are going to think that you're AI, but you're totally right. The second thing is... I don't think it's AI's fault that you're bad at grammar if you don't know how to use an M-dash or read with an M-dash. Like, it writes that way because people like to read content in that way, where it's like you start a thought, you segue to a secondary thought, and then you come back to the original thought. That is not necessarily AI's fault that it's writing that way. That's how human beings like to have a conversation. I guarantee if we were transcribing this right now, you'd see a crap ton of M-dashes, because that's how conversations happen in real life with real people.
Well, yeah. And I think a lot of people, they're so afraid of the new that they forget that the new becomes the now becomes the always. And like, so, and it's like anything, right? Like, you go back, like when Ford started putting cars out on the street, right? Guzzler, I'm riding my horse. All it needs is some hay. It's like you could literally just go all through from the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I lived through the beginning of the internet age into my whole career has been on the internet since early, like 2001. I was all in on the internet. And I've seen it time and time and time and time and time and time again. The new thing comes, the new way of doing things come. Everybody's too smart and too educated and too good at what they do with their craft. And then 3 years later, they're obsolete. And all the people who were following what was happening step to the forefront. And then those people will now circle back around, come back to that person, go, how do you do it? And you say, you know, that thing you said was stupid 3 years ago, start doing it now. And then they all start doing it.
And the hard part, and by the way, I love the phrase, the new is the now is the always, because you're 100% right. Right. I'm an early adopter. So by nature, I'm excited about everything that's new and exciting. I wanted those Google Glasses when they first came out, even though they were ugly. I've been on ChatGPT since before it was even a paid subscription, right? But what that means is I end up with a lot of people that are like trying to catch up with what I'm working on. And by the time they've caught up, I've moved on to the next great, exciting, interesting thing. And that can be really hard when I am working with team members, when I have people that I'm expected to lead. So you mentioned that you have a team that you work with in our pre-podcast conversation. Tell me how you help them drive forward with the new, the now, the always, and keep up with that in our world that's changing every single day.
Well, I just started this about a year ago. So although I've been in this industry, me and my partner, December 23, he bought me out, spent a few months, had a wedding coming up, things like that. Then May 1st, 24, launched me, my VA. Here we are a year later, 150 clients, 40 people on the team, you know, X amount of ARR, like things are progressing. But one of the things I did in starting my company was I said two things. One is I said, we are AI integration forward. So every person that joined my team knows that we are AI integration forward. So that we're always, and then the second thing, and I say this time and time and time and time again, is we always want to be better, faster, with less friction. If we could be better, faster, with less friction internally, externally for our clients, in our processes, in our interactions with each other, in the way that we do things for our clients and with our clients, we are going to have a much easier life. An illustration of that, a year ago when we launched our product, we do a podcast, about a 30-minute podcast. With that podcast, we gave them three pieces of content. One that went out before the show, one that went around the same time as the show, and one that went after the show. But being AI forward and the growth that we've had, we now produce for one episode, 30-minute shot, 30-minute podcast shoot, we produce 30 pieces of content. We will place them for them on up to 10 outlets daily, which means that a year ago, we would place three pieces of content on five outlets, which means we, for each podcast, we would give them 15 actions. We now, for each podcast, give them up to 300 actions. And I have basically the same workflow. Now, we use AI, then eyes, then QA, then what we call final QA, the guy who can lose his job if stuff slips through, is what I tell him. And so I don't just like, we're not just blindly using every AI tool and throwing stuff out there. We're trying to filter it through humanity to make it better, to fix the hiccups and the things that are still there. But that is what I try to do, is just lead my team and constantly say, guys, better, faster, less friction. Guys, we're AI forward. So I'm always casting that as part of our DNA as a company. And that enables them or disables them from being like fighting change and fighting. Like when a new program comes in, people don't fight me. They're just like, okay, I guess we got to try it. Cause I'm like, hey, the goal is better, faster, less friction. And so they can't just be like, I don't like, you know, it's just so integration, trying new things. I also have a very high tolerance for failure. Because to me, I would rather have somebody, and I don't mean failure because they didn't do it right, but when it's a new project, a new thing, and you're learning and you're growing and you're trying to get better, you have to create an atmosphere where people aren't afraid to fall on their face, get back up and try again. And so that is another way that I try to do that, because people bring me programs, they bring me thoughts and suggestions and other things. Because they know if they provide value to the company, they make us better, faster, with less friction, they'll be rewarded for it publicly, privately, financially, whatever.
How do you interface that with your customers? Because like my preconceived notion of the legal profession is that they are not necessarily risk takers or not necessarily like a super innovative industry as a whole. So tell me a little bit about what the reaction is when you talk to clients about this idea of like, we're going to be better, we're going to be faster, we're going to be less friction because we're AI forward. Do you get a lot of concern, or is it just the people you're attracting already know that and that's why they're coming?
I think people care about the results more than they do the actual mechanisms. And so as long as we can, that's why we have the triple QA and the other things, is because if we were purely just like, you know, the sort of like, I don't care that names are misspelled, we're just throwing videos out, we got to do 30 a day. Like, if we were doing that, yes, we would have lots of problems. But when we still produce a product with spelling right, graphics right, everything right, video right, you know, productions right, what do they say to that? Like, there's not much that they can say. So for us, it's more about making sure that the end deliverable matches the expectations. And we don't preach all of the better, faster, less friction to our clients. We preach it internally, and we seek to do it for our clients externally. But it's not like we have, you know, company call or client calls, and today's subject is better, faster, less friction. Hey, look how great AI is doing on cutting clips. Like, we don't do that. We, you know, it's like, they don't want to know how the sausage is made. They just want the sausage. Okay, let's change that. But you get my point.
Totally, 100%. So let's talk about then what you're working on when it comes to your legal podcast approach to, like, how do we take people and get them into the Legal Podcast Network? And why did you even start it in the first place?
So I originally started it. I've been in marketing for 30 years. Digital marketing for 20-something years, focusing with attorneys for 20-something years. That's kind of how I got into digital, was personal injury attorneys. So the attorney side of things is very easy for me. They're rooted in logic. They're open to discussion. Like, you know what I mean? So you're not using like spin selling, and I don't even know the name of the rest of the books because I don't really read them. But, you know, I don't know all these different sort of like selling positions. I'm just like, I just talk to people, have an honest conversation, make them tell me the truth. I tell them the truth. And then if, you know, I don't agree with them, I give them my counterpoint and they give me their counterpoint. And sometimes the attorney says, you know what, that makes sense. Let's work together. So that's why I like attorneys, is we can stay in logic. Why podcasting? I did a podcast in Austin, did about 60 episodes, 3 months. We did it on site. I had a crew of 10 people. It was like half YouTube show, half podcast. It was called ATXAF. And we ended up doing something like, you know, we had like entrepreneurs, musicians, chefs, influencers. And we would go on site in like cool places and like have just like cool Austin vibes, like always on all of our different sets of shows. And so having done that and seeing the difference that production value made in that community and in the relationships I built, and even in the videos that I did a video with Ali Khan from Food Network, Good Eats. So like, you know, Austin kind of has a lot of like celebrities, pseudo celebrities, like, so I was able to like start pulling from those sort of people. But so I knew podcasting, and I knew that podcasting at a higher production level was something that was needed. So attorneys don't want to look like they're just sitting in their living room with their iPhone. And I tell them straight up, I'm like, listen, any 8-year-old can have a podcast. They can set up their iPhone, talk into the camera for 20 minutes, upload it to iTunes, and they've got a podcast.
I was joking with my 6-year-old last night. She was sitting on the porch with me and she was just talking. I'm like, you know what, Char, you should have a podcast. It can be Yaps with Charlotte. And she's like, yeah. And then we just recorded a bunch of little clips. So you're right. Any 6-year-old can have a podcast. It's not that hard to do. But production quality, that's a differentiator.
That's the key. And I like to use one example for production value. You think about like, let's go pre, you know, internet, where we were making our own shows and we were all media stars in our own right, whether we had 3 fans, 3 million or 300 million, right? But you think about like, if someone came up to you as like, man, I have a TV show, you'd be like, what?
Mind-blowing.
A TV show, yes. Right? But then they're like, it's on tonight on this channel. So you go to the channel and it's like the public access channel.
Right.
And they've got like a cheap curtain behind them and they're sitting on folding chairs and a grainy camera. At that moment, you are no longer impressed with the show that they have on TV. But if at the same time, they say, it's on NBC tonight, 7:30, it's a 15-minute segment. I sit there and they've got all the trappings and the professional cameras and everything, you're going to be a lot more impressed. But yet here we are in the internet age, and production value on the internet as a whole is going up. But here's the thing. X, boomers, and even late millennials are just now getting into, hey, I'm comfortable with my face on the computer. The problem is your daughter's 6 years old. She's already, by the time she's 16, she'll spend 10 years as a superstar.
Yep.
In a way, right?
My 10-year-old has a YouTube channel that he's been building for 3 years. So, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So I tell attorneys, I'm like, you have 14-year-old kids with three camera crews, a sound person walking around with higher production value, and you're supposed to be a personal injury attorney doing $50 million a year.
Yeah. And so, the kid down the street who is just talking about nothing and pulling pranks in the neighborhood has higher production value than you when you have real value to bring and you're not like just producing brain rot.
Exactly. So what we're trying to do as a company is like our production team, you know, our content team, our, you know, our producers, our hosts. We have professional hosts that, you know, US based, been podcast hosts for 10 years. Our production person, she produced a podcast for Stephen King, for Michael Cohen. She worked for Spotify. You know what I mean? Like, these are the calibers of individuals that we're working with. And thank God for the remote age, right? Because they're in Denver and they're in here and there, and they're just like, wait, I can have the same career, but yet not have to move all around the world. And so we just come to these attorneys and we're like, listen, you're smart. You need to set yourself apart from the myriad of other criminal defense attorneys in Atlanta. How do you do that? Number one, you need to show authoritative positioning. You need to start showing people that you're not just a, oh yeah, I can handle that. But you need to drill down on the types of clients that you want, the cases that you want, the issues that you want to be handling, and answer those questions. Why? Several reasons. One, for one, people would much rather listen to a podcast or watch a video than read an article, right? Yep. That's just reality. But beyond that, the algorithm is double favoring video content that is question-based. All these learning language models are based off of query-based search. They're based off of literally, this humanity has questions. We're doing all we can to be able to answer them all. And then we're going to cite the people who give us the trusted information. So I'm trying to tell them, don't wait 5 years when there's 10 podcasts just like yours in your town. Be the first criminal defense attorney so that when this language learning model becomes the predominant, whatever it is, ChatGPT, OpenAI, or whatever it is, when it becomes the predominant source of information and you're the one being cited, you're the one being cited. Plus, so that's future-proofing your content, right? But then we've got present-proofing our content. Who owns YouTube? Google. What does Google know? Google knows that 80% of people would rather watch a video than read an article. So now, when you provide the answer, Google will put that answer in, you know, your little YouTube clips at the top. People prefer that. They click on it now. They listen to 10 minutes of your podcast. They go to your website. They see all your, and maybe they're high asset individual going through a divorce with ugly custody issues. And you've just got 4, 5, 6, 20 minute podcasts that deal with that exact issue. Now, instead of being attorney number 7 on my list of 30 to talk to, you've now become the person I want to work with because you have helped people with my exact issue. So that's why we've chosen to do this way. That's why we use these methods. Podcasting is a means to an end. Now, podcasting is evergreen. There might be something that down the road comes out of it. But in all actuality, we just use podcast as the phrase of the day because attorneys are going to these conferences and they're like, you got to have a podcast. And so it's like, oh, I guess I need a podcast. And then we call them up. We're like, you want a podcast? And they're like, all right, I'm supposed to have a podcast. And so then we show them how we do it and how it doesn't take much of their time. And it's not, you know, it's designed for smaller firms. So it's cost effective and all the different things that we do for it. And we say, would you like to be a part of it? And 70% of the time when they sit and meet with one of my team members, they say, absolutely, I'd love to work.
The funny thing too is, like, obviously I'm a podcaster, so you don't have to like sell me on podcasting. I love it. But it's interesting too in some of those professional services that it's kind of a foreign idea to them. But the reality is that people buy from people that they know and that they like. And podcasting is a great way for you to build a parasocial relationship with your prospective customers, because they might feel like they already know you. There's a ton of people who listen to my podcast I've never met before. But if I meet them at an event, they will reference something personally about me. Be like, oh yeah, you have a son, you have a daughter, you have a blah, blah, blah. All the things that we'll talk about across all of the episodes. And I've never spoken to them before, but they feel as if they already know me. And that's nothing but an advantage for someone who is looking to provide services. If your customers come in feeling as if they've already known you, they've already made the decision to hire you. So why not use podcasting as a way to broadcast who you are as a person?
That's exactly what we say. So I say, you know, the old world, no, like, trust. The content marketing is no, like, and then the final call is confirming trust. Basically, all they're verifying is this the same person that I watched on video, or is it somebody?
Or was it all an act?
Exactly. So once they verify that, now they trust them. So the no, like, trust, boom, it's right there for them. And so that's what I love about this sort of thing. And then you were talking about, like, people knowing you. I mean, I live on an island with like 25,000 people, and I don't know everybody, but, you know, a few hundred people. But like, I go to these like social events and I sit down next to somebody and they're like, oh, hey, DM. And I'm like, oh, hey. And then they'll be like, you know, in that one episode, because I put out like 3 a week and I just put them out on my personal, and then people on the island share them and talk about them. And I'm just like, okay, like, you're interested in lawyer marketing on an island in the middle of Belize, like, either
more power to you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you enjoy it. But I get into some personal stuff and talk about other things in podcasting than just lawyer stuff. But the point is, like, I'll sit, like, we went on this catamaran, like, about, I don't know, about 2 months ago. And this lady sat next to me and she just kept talking to me and talking to me and talking to me and talking. And finally, at the end of the thing, and I knew she knew my wife, because my wife does a lot more of, like, she, like, right now she's at Taco Tuesday with like 50 ladies or whatever, you know? So I was like, why does that lady act like she knows me? And she goes, oh, she loves you. She listens to all your podcasts. She always tells me stuff about, she knows more about you than I do. And I'm your wife, because my wife won't listen to my podcast. She says, I've got a big enough ego. She doesn't need to feed into it.
So. My husband doesn't listen to mine either. I'm 90 episodes in, and I think he's maybe listened to 2. And I know when he listens, because he'll be like, I didn't appreciate whatever, you know, he thinks I'm writing podcasts
just
to teach him. Like,
yeah.
I have another podcast called Taking Back Monday, and it's all about, like, how do we fight the Sunday scaries? How do we create the future of work that we love? And he goes, that felt like a personal attack on my approach to work. I'm like, it wasn't about you, but that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and what I do is I'm like, all right, dear, this is, like, I don't make you watch all of them, but this is a really good one. And it's not just business. And I put it on my big screen YouTube, and I'm like, we're sitting down and watching it 20, 30 minutes. I tell her it's the price of admission for living with me and benefiting from the company that we've created.
There you go. There you go. So considering your clients and everyone that you've had a chance to meet, and of course, you know, you've been in this podcasting for, how long did you say you've been doing this?
I did my podcast in Austin in 19, hiatus, but now we really just started back up a little over a year ago.
Awesome. Well,
a year and a half.
That's, I mean, honestly, that's like a lifetime in podcasting world, I feel like. We were talking about this earlier, that, like, what, 99% of all podcasts never make it past episode 10 or something like that. So to have do more than 10, you've already reached the upper 1%, which is exciting. Considering all of those people, though, who do you think is really leading the charge? Who's driving the way we build those relationships with our customers?
You mean within my organization or just in the world in general?
Whoever you think, like, the thought leaders, the people who are out there, whether you know them or you aspire to know them, like, who else should we be listening to?
I mean, you know, there's the obvious ones like Stephen Bartlett. You know, I think he has a show, Diary of a CEO, out of England. And then one that I've really enjoyed is Vanessa Van Edwards. I don't know if you're familiar with her. she kind of fuses psychology into interpersonal communication and just teaches you like certain things. Like one thing that she taught me, and I had to change my whole podcast setup, was, is that when people cannot see your hands, there is an innate caveman distrust of not seeing somebody's hands. And so the faster you can show your hands, especially if you can show them open, I usually try to begin each episode like this and say, oh yeah, this, because it signifies I'm open, I'm comfortable, you can trust me.
Yeah.
And so like, and she's got a million things like that. You know, I think, I can't remember if she was the one that talked about like the emotional psychological impact of somebody you love rolling their eyes at you. And so she just basically takes like visual cues that are kind of part of everyday life, and with her psychology background, infuses those into our everyday communication. And I think she does a tremendous job with it. I would say probably more than anybody else, I pay attention to her, and you have a crush on her or nothing. I'm married. She's married, but she's just brilliant. Right. And so, and then, what is the name of, there's one more lady who, she's very business focused. I'll give it to you later and you can put it in the show notes.
I will.
She's very granular business. She's not like one of those, like, you know, cause you got the Alex and Layla Hormozy. I'm not big on them. They're brilliant. They do a great job. They're just not my vibe. You know, they're more of the like, let's go business, you know, like, and I'm just like,
and you're on an island. So, I mean, exactly. we can't be that intense on the island.
Exactly. I'm just like, whoa. Like, I put in a solid 6 hours today. It's time to go chill.
Right.
So, but yeah, so there's a lot out there, but I would say of the ones that really have impacted me, Vanessa Van Edwards is probably one of the biggest like LinkedIn social influencers that I've seen more from than anybody else and applied more from directly.
Well, I'm going to have to definitely start following her because I love that. If someone is really interested, they want to start doing this, what is the number one thing you would have them do first?
Decide. You mean podcasting, period?
Yeah. If they're a lawyer or someone in kind of professional services roles.
Okay.
What would you advise them to do? What's the first thing they should do if they want to start exploring podcasting?
They need to decide who their ultimate, their, what I call their ICP, their, not the insane clown posse, but their ideal client profile. They need to decide who that is. Because there are too many attorneys who are just like, well, I just want any case, just whatever comes along.
If you have money and a retainer, I'll take it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you're just like, no, like, I get it. You're a divorce attorney. But like, are you telling me that if I sent you 10 $500 simple divorces of 22-year-olds with no assets, they both just want to end the thing, that you'd be just as happy as if I sent you 5 high asset divorces with millions of dollars to split up and custody issues and properties? And you're probably going to make, I had one lawyer tell me he made $6 million on one divorce.
Jeez.
Now it was a billionaire's divorce. And I thought, well, then you didn't make much, but he made $6 million. Now, obviously that is a huge outlier, but as a, you know, for somebody, he could be making $250,000 he or she as a divorce lawyer, if they're working with the right people. And as most people in business know, it usually takes less effort to help people with more money at a higher cost than it does to help people with less money at a lower cost. They usually demand way more when they have way less.
Yep.
And so when they identify that ideal client, they can then build their content backwards from that person and their needs. What most people do in creating a marketing venue, whether it's a podcast, a YouTube show, or whatever, they start with who they are and try to emanate that outwards in hopes of attracting whatever. And I'm just like, you're doing it the opposite way. You should be starting where you want to end up and building a road backwards from it.
Yep.
You remember those little mazes where you had to like draw the thing through? And you remember if you started at the beginning, you'd usually fail a few times. But what was the easiest way to get through that maze?
It's always starting at the end. Always.
Exactly. And that's what we need to be doing with our marketing. start at the end and work the maze backwards.
Yep. And I think to your point, a lot of people design their podcasts when they first get started. They design them around themselves, their stories that they want to tell, their experiences and that kind of stuff. But if you want to survive in your podcast, or even better, like make money and have it be something that becomes a revenue driver for you, you have to design it in a way that attracts other people in. And it can't just be something that you do for yourself. Because in that case, just record some TikToks in the mirror and call it a day. But if what you're really here to do is grow, then that's what you have to do.
Exactly. Or a passion project. So like, yes, we're getting ready to launch two shows. One is called BAM, Building Authority Through Media. I am BAM Man. And we are conquering sameness. Our first series, we're about to shoot the last two episodes. We're journeying through the land of LinkedIn. And it's a narrative style where I have another expert come in as my dynamic duo. And then we come into I think this week we're talking about LinkedIn, the inbox, and we're talking about newsletters and how to best utilize those. But we call it the desert zone of LinkedIn or something like that right now.
Yeah.
And so we're building like this narrative thing. So that's business, a little bit of entertainment, a little bit of fun. Then my second show that I'm doing is called The Temple of Enthusiasm, which is not going to claim that's, I saw it on the back of a t-shirt when I was in Bali. And I was like, that is a brilliant name for a podcast, The Temple of Enthusiasm. And all I'm planning on doing is getting people on the other side and I just want people who are super, super passionate. I mean, even to the point where they're like, why is this guy only interviewing people on the spectrum? I don't even care. Like, I want super, super passionate people about very, very specific things. And I just want to spend an hour going, are you kidding me? The blue yarn is better than the aquamarine yarn, because there's blue yarn. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I want, is like an hour of me and someone else geeking out about something, because I can geek out about anything if their energy's there. And I think people would enjoy that. I think they'd like get in and be like, yeah, I just watched a podcast about, remember Pogs? I guess there's like a whole like scene of it. People still play Pogs. And there's, you know, this guy was on there. He's the president of the United States Pog Association. And like that's the kind of shows I want to have, or episodes I want to have with that show. So I think you should have a creative outlet. I tell all business people, really anybody, like, what we do can be a creative outlet, but it shouldn't be the creative outlet for us. So that's why I want to create another show, so that I can enjoy podcasting, not just do podcasting.
I love that. I love that. I so agree too. DM, if someone is really connecting with you, if they want to learn more, if they want to talk to you about starting a podcast, being on podcasts, or, you know, their hobby, their obsession, their passion, where can they find you online?
So first of all, LinkedIn, I try to provide as much value. So if you're a business owner and LinkedIn is kind of your zone that you hang out in, I try to create as much value as I can there between video and content and relationships and everything else. So obviously LinkedIn, our company website, thelegalpodcastnetwork.com. And then I have a website. You can check it out. We'll see when this releases. It is in, like, I have the mock-up done for it that I'm tweaking. But I want to get to the point where when people say, tell me about your business, I just want to say, go to imnotgonnapitchyounow.com. And that's got all my me stuff, where if you want to buy or connect or whatever, like, I want to just talk about subjects. Now, do we have one more question? Because I have one in the chamber, but I'm not sure if I already answered the question.
Yeah, throw it in. I'm through with my official, but I want to hear what's rattling around your brain.
Well, because you asked me who are the influencers, mm-hmm. but the question originally in my mind was, who is the person
someone on the hot seat. Yes.
Right.
Let's hear your hot seat.
Are you familiar with Ryan Holiday?
No. Tell me more.
Okay. Are you familiar with Stoicism?
Yes.
Okay. Cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, is based out of Stoicism. It is a very solid life philosophy, not in every area, because a lot of it's about like sleep on a stone and eat bread for a week to prove that you don't need, you know, the creature comfort. So I'm not that stoic, I'll be honest. But Ryan Holiday He's actually based out of the office, out of the Austin area. I've ran into him once or twice, had a half a conversation. Not going to act like he's my best friend or anything. But he writes a series of books. The first one is called The Obstacle is the Way. Right here I have one called Stillness is the Key. And he takes Stoic principles and he makes them easily digestible, one principle by principle. And what it enables you to do, I will tell you, the book, The Obstacle is the Way. I went through a divorce. My best friend, who is also my sister's husband, who had a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, and my sister was pregnant, died within a very short amount of time, literally. And I grew up in church. As a matter of fact, I was a pastor for 20 years, but I kind of stepped away from all of that in my life. So I no longer had that core fundamental life philosophy to live by. And I remember just being in bed and just grabbing this book and just being like, I need something to help me through this time, because I am not holding on to, I don't have anything to hold on to. And I read that book, The Obstacle is the Way. And very simply, it's just a few principles in there that really applied to me. But one is, what you're going through, allow yourself to go through it, because there are lessons and life things that you're going to get if you try to scoot around it or skip it. But then the other thing that really changed me was he gave this illustration, because he's talking about not allowing emotions to be the ruling factor in our life. And he basically said, hey, listen, if someone walked up to you and was just like, be mad, you need to be mad, you'd be like, who are you? Don't tell me what to do. But yet when that emotion of anger or hurt or embarrassment or whatever that negative emotion is washes over us, instead of us allowing it to pass through and be like, I don't know what your problem is, we internalize and hold on to it. And we allow it to then become the ruling factor of the moment. So then when I began to feel that hurt, that pain, that frustration, that anger, whatever emotion that it was, I learned to acknowledge it. And I know this is a very simple, CBT-like principle, but it just hit me the right way, where it was just like, I learned to acknowledge it, I learned to feel it, and then I learned to let it go for what it was. And his books, and again, he's got, 5 or 6 books that teach on different things, patience, stillness, life, whatever, have helped me tremendously throughout my journey from that point where I didn't have a core belief system. Now I have a core philosophy that I can live by that helps me through these times. And so that is the person that I put out there as having impacted me in a tremendous way.
Well, that is a perfect way to end it. Thank you so much for coming on the Growth Signal. This was a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate your time and your expertise.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.